Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 30, July 30, 2006. That will should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before we get into the show, I want to remind listeners that there are four ways to contact the podcast. The first is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, the website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, our voicemail, 206-600-4216, and lastly, by physical mail, Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, 30065 in the United States. On today's show, I have three different interviews. The first is with David Shoemaker about his work with 418 Lodge in Sacramento, the Psychology Guild, and the OTO's ongoing pastoral counseling program. The second interview is a discussion with Keith 418 about confrontation within the Thelemic community. The last interview is with Stephen Ash regarding the Kabbalah and his book, The Kabbalah of the 50 Gates. Before getting into the feedback in the interviews, I want to remind everyone that sending a postcard to Thelema Coast to Coast will get you a sticker. And this is a sticker that has the Thelema Coast to Coast logo on it. It says Occultism Without Apologies and has the Thelema Coast to Coast website. All you have to do is send a postcard to the P.O. box and I'll return the stickers to you. So let's get into the listener feedback. The first one is from a listener named Johnson Miller.
I just listened to show 29. It's Johnson Miller from Virginia. It's another great show. A couple things. First, I love Pastor Wilcox's message. I think you ought to play them all, especially if they also contain threats of violence like the one you played. I can't imagine what else getting Old Testament on your ass means other than something violent. Second, as someone working on the history of Virginia Military Institute, your show is the last place I expected to hear references to VMI. And the third thing is, I wonder, is there any evidence of OTO membership increasing over the years since the show started, or for that matter, evidence of membership decreasing? Thanks a lot for all your great work.
Thanks for the feedback, Johnson. Well, in regard to your question about the increased membership, the OTO membership increases and decreases every year. I don't know of anybody leaving the OTO per se by the podcast. I do know that some people have contacted me and told me that they've come into the OTO because of the podcast, or that the podcast has helped them get back on their Thelemic path or looked into Thelema, things like that. But I think there's a large number of factors on why people would join the OTO and leave the OTO. I do think as a trend, the numbers have been decreasing somewhat, but I don't know how accurate the numbers that have been put out in the past are. So, as far as I'm aware, the worldwide membership of the OTO is approximately 2,500, give or take, where about 1,400 or 1,500 of those are in the United States. And again, these numbers are approximate, so I don't know exactly, but it's somewhere around that. I know of maybe about half a dozen people have joined the order because of the podcast, so clearly that doesn't make that large of a dent in there. But Nevertheless, I'm glad that the podcast has gotten some people active in Thelema. So thanks for that question. And you also touched on the subject of the biggest topic of feedback, Associate Pastor Wilcox. Well, I need to let everybody know that Associate Pastor Zebulon Wilcox, although sounds very convincing, is actually the creation of a production company in Georgia called Blue Deer Productions. And they have done a mockumentary about a South Georgia or a rural Georgia church in which Associate Pastor Wilcox is one of the characters in it. This is this production company is associated with an OTO brother and someone I know, so I wanted to give them a little press, and we had a little fun with that. It seems that Associate Pastor Wilcox really did rile quite a few people up, and in fact, he seems to have been a bit of inspiration for one of our OTO brothers, Scholar. He's been featured on this program before. He has written a song about Thelemic conversion and Associate Pastor Wilcox. So here's the Scholar song about Thelemic conversion.
Zebulon Wilcox here. Here's the thing, the dark side of Satan.
Ha ha ha! Scholar!
Back to protect the path and stand up against a never-ending rising tide of half-wits and no-brain followers following anything written in a book edited over many millennia. Do what you're told, impress, repress, repress. Never question any of the many gaps in the good book. Keep your eyes on your own intolerance and set it straight. Get it straight. What's next?
The Thelemic conversion?
Right, Zeb, thanks for reminding me of things you can't conceive or even comprehend. Why would anybody want to do anything other than what Slave Master J.C. decrees? Christianity was used in Haiti to control the so-called savage habitat. Imagine trading your individuality in for commonality. It's insane. If you think it through but don't think, just trust. Have faith, don't make a fuss. Beat down, keep down your lust. I won't do it, it's everything that is life. Don't think, just trust.
Conversion?
Have faith, don't make a fuss. Beat down, keep down your lust. I won't do it, it's everything that is life. What's satanic to you? 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 What's satanic to me is eating every lie that has ever fed to me. What's satanic to you? What's satanic to you? What's satanic to you? What's satanic to you? What's satanic to me? What's satanic to me is eating every lie that has ever fed to me. Scholar. Thelemic conversion remix. Zebulon the automaton on the telephone. Beast out.
Podcast 28 done taking the cake.
I hope you've found that song amusing. As soon as Scholar sent it to me, I absolutely loved it. It was great. And I appreciate him taking the time to put that together. I'm glad you all liked or were very interested in the comments of Associate Pastor Zebulon Wilcox. And unfortunately, he will not be coming back on the show anymore. But if you want more information about the Blue Deer Productions and some of the other things about the mockumentary and so forth, you can go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and go to the forum thread called the Poplar Creek Church, and it has all of the information in there. So thanks again for all the people who sent feedback, and I received quite a bit of it, and Johnson and Scholar who sent in the audio. Okay. Any listener of the podcast knows for quite a while we've been doing giveaways with Latex Records. On the last podcast, I played a song from the Kali Yuga album, The Cosmology of Decay. And the winner of that CD is Steven from Astoria, New York. So congratulations, Steven. And that leaves one last CD. And that is the Latex Records Primal River Valley. This is a 2-CD set that has 28 songs on it. It's a very nice CD, lots of remixes, industrial music, and so forth. And I was going to play a song off that, but I have a different treat at the end of the program. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give this last Primal River Valley CD away. And the winner of this CD is Dixie in Austin, Texas. So congratulations, Dixie. I'll be sending these CDs out. And that is all of the CDs that we have from Latex Records. So congratulations to all those who have won the CDs. And thanks again to Latex Records for supplying those to the podcast. Now, our first interview, as I said before, is with David Shoemaker. David is the body master of 418 Lodge in Sacramento. He's also the president of the Psychology Guild and a very accomplished musician. In fact, the music that you hear in the background, I'm actually experimenting with having background music for the first time. This music is produced by David. He also has a number of other CDs that he has put out, movie soundtracks, all instrumental, very wonderful music. He has been the editor of a journal that just came out from 418. I apologize, not just came out a little while ago. The journal is called Crête, and he also is the president of the Psychology Guild, which has also come out with a journal called Neshma. I think the next project he's working on is the next version of Chet, and then after that, they'll be doing the next Psychology Guild newsletter. So, to get more information about that and let people know about what the Psychology Guild is doing, here's David Shoemaker.
We have on the phone with us David Shoemaker. Are you there, David?
I sure am, John.
93, welcome to the podcast.
93, thank you for having me.
For those who are not aware of you, you are the body master of 418 Lodge in Sacramento, California, and you're also the president of the Psychology Guild within the OTO.
Correct.
How did you get into magic?
Well, I am a clinical psychologist, and when I was in graduate school, one of the directions that was really appealing to me and one of my professors who was particularly influential was a Jungian-oriented person, and so we did a lot of work with studying the works of Carl Jung, and this got me drawn into what in the field would be called depth psychology as opposed to maybe the more mainstream cognitive behavioral kind of approach, and therefore my mind was opened fairly early in my training to looking for archetypes in the world around us. We're looking at myths, we're looking at the utility of ritual and that sort of thing. And so it really wasn't a big jump to discover the work of Rigardi, who then was writing about Crowley and connecting psychology and magic together. So that was kind of my bridge over into magic from psychology.
Now, Rigardi makes the comment often that people practicing magic should have some kinds of therapy. I've even heard like 100 hours or something like that. What are your thoughts about that?
I think people in general should have therapy. I'm not saying that to line my pockets, but because there is, I think, inherent value in, no matter how self-reflective we are, no matter how much work we've done on ourselves, there's something of inherent value in sitting with someone you've asked to help you and to get that outside perspective in a fairly intimate setting on your issues, your history, your growth process as a dialogue. I just think that's a unique opportunity that everybody could potentially benefit from. So certainly, if we're going in, if you're in the path of magic and mysticism and you're wanting to obviously do some pretty deep exploration of yourself, I think beginning it by a process like therapy it can be extremely important.
Now, should the therapist be pro magical practices or experimental spirituality, or does that really make a difference?
I think what's most important is that the therapist is open-minded to integration of spiritual issues or alternative religious, you know, however you want to frame it, but the open-mindedness is the crucial thing rather than necessarily a particular theoretical orientation. But generally speaking, someone who's trained as a Jungian or would identify themselves as a transpersonal psychologist, for example, those people are probably going to have a more open mind to alternative practices. So I think that's a pretty good idea to try to do some homework and find someone who fits that description.
Okay. Well, let's move into your kind of realm as the body master of 418 Lodge. What are some of the things that 418 has been doing?
Well, for the last 2 years, what we've basically been doing is rebuilding ourselves. We The lodge was actually founded in 1979 by Phyllis Eckler, Sora Merrill, of course, and therefore had existed for 25 years, but for the last decade or so had been pretty much inactive. I'd consider myself a member of it once I moved out here to California, but Phyllis wasn't particularly active in doing initiations and formal lodge-sponsored activities in the later years of her life. So when she passed the mastership to me in the spring of 2004, which was about a month before her death, we've really since that time emphasized getting ourselves functioning as a lodge should function, you know, making sure masses are happening regularly, making sure that classes are occurring, making sure that initiations are available, and really building back an OTO community here in Sacramento, which hadn't really had a body for several years.
Now, you've put out a publication recently as 418?
Uh-huh. The first issue of our journal, Keth, as in the Hebrew letter Keth, came out late last year, and we're accepting submissions for the second volume, which we expect to be out within the next 6 months or so.
And what format is that in? A book or just saddle stitch?
It is a perfect bound, small format, perfect bound book, somewhat like a literary journal.
Okay.
With some very nice artwork. And this particular issue features a lot of Phyllis's art and poetry. So it's kind of a memorial issue for her, but that's the format.
Okay. Well, let's move to the Psychology Guild. When did that get founded?
Right about the time that I was getting into magic, the first 2 or 3 years after joining the OTO in 93, I read about the concept of the guilds from, you know, the Constitution and such, and realized there was that one of the guilds that might be most useful and most inherently kind of overlapping with magic and mysticism would be a psychology guild. And maybe that's just my own bias, but it seemed pretty obvious. And so I started writing to various folks to kind of check out the idea and see who would be interested. And Sabazius and Sora Helena from the very beginning were very supportive of developing the guild. So we started working, writing up the bylaws, and on that score we had a lot of assistance from the Translators Guild bylaws, which had been around for a year or two at that point. So we wrote up the bylaws, and then it was formally approved. The guild was formally approved in the spring of 2000, and since that time we've done a journal, one volume of a journal called Neshima, and which is now sold out, but hope to do another one here in the next year. And we've got about 20 members internationally. Of course, the guild is an international body. And right now, the project that certainly is at the center of our work is the pastoral counseling workshops that we're doing around the country.
Okay. What are the pastoral workshops that you're doing?
Well, basically, the idea started with the recognition that out there in the field, in any town, USA, where there's an OTO body, there are people in that setting who, no matter what their training, no matter what their background, no matter what their degree, they are kind of the de facto spiritual leaders of the community, the OTO EGC community. There's someone who's going to walk into that community as a Minerval and see that there's a priest or priestess up there doing these functions, and like it or not, they're going to be seen as the authority. Likely going to be seen as the authority figure there, and they're going to come across people who come to them for advice or come to them with a problem or simply manifest a problem in the community, and that's going to have to be dealt with by someone. I came up with the idea of starting these workshops in order to do the training for body masters and for ordained clergy to be prepared for what they will find themselves doing, because I think it's inevitable that these issues will arise.
And what kind of issues do the clergy within the EGC of the OTO get from the various members? What kind of things are you preparing them for?
Well, the workshops themselves cover a few key areas. One of them, of course, is basic counseling skills, listening skills, understanding how to approach their community members, not as a therapist doing long-term work for change in healing in terms of actual psychiatric diagnoses and that sort of thing, but in terms of support, empathy. Another component of the workshops is making sure that our folks know enough about psychiatric diagnosis in a basic way so that they can detect if someone is having a more serious issue that might need a referral to resources in the community. We also go over legal and ethical issues. Major example of that that was featured in an article in Agape a while back was the issue of mandatory reporting of child abuse and neglect. And in many states, clergy, which would include ordained priests, priestesses, and bishops, are mandated reporters of child abuse. And so issues like that, certainly there needs to be education about that.
Now, there has been some criticism of the pastoral counseling that the OTO is going out and doing these kind of counseling sessions, but that the clergy themselves are really kind of ignorant about the EGC and Gnosticism and things like that. Do you see that as a problem, or what's your kind of response to that criticism?
Well, I think training is always multifaceted, and we identified a need, and at the time of identifying the need, we also had a body that could exist to help work on that. You know, so we identified that pastoral counseling was a useful thing to do. We identified that the guild was there with clinically trained members to do it, and the resources were available. So I think it's a question of working with what you have and can easily implement. Certainly doesn't diminish the importance of rounding out the training in other ways.
So where do you see the Psychology Guild going with the counseling sessions? Is that going to be something that rotates and you do twice a year, kind of like what the OTO does with the CABA? Or is it going to become a more elaborate, documented process? Or are you still just kind of working out the initial details?
Well, we've done one beta test, as I like to call it, in this last summer, and then we've done three workshops in Los Angeles, Austin, and Portland so far. They've been roughly quarterly. And it's similar to a CABA model of showing up with a panel of presenters, usually two or three, and doing a full weekend-long workshop experience. And in terms of where to take it from here, we're still trying to make one complete pass around all the geographic areas in the country. I'd really like to hit the upper Midwest and the Southeast at this point. We have one scheduled for New York City in September. And so we're trying to hit everybody in the first pass with that and make sure that everyone's had access to at least come to one of them. It's not going to be a certification program. We're not saying that someone is trained as a pastoral counselor after one weekend. What we're doing is trying to get some minimal exposure to these tools and to the education aspect of it. In the future, you know, if someone has a counseling credential, and as there are more and more pagan-oriented or pagan-friendly seminaries existing out there, it may very well be possible to have some of our clergy be formally accredited as pastoral counselors. But that's a bit down the road.
What are some of the other things that the Psychology Guild is thinking? You said they're coming out with another NESHMA in the near future. Are there some other kind of programs that you're thinking of, or is this pretty much your main concentration right now?
Well, let me describe a little bit more about what we envisioned the Guild to be when it was first started. I think that would help. First of all, it's not purely clinically oriented. It wasn't designed to be a psychotherapy or psychotherapist guild. It was designed to be, broadly speaking, psychology and frankly, even bridging into other social sciences type of a guild. So we have people who are trained in research, social science research, social psychologists, other experimental psychologists. We have psychiatrists. We have graduate students in all these fields. So it's really designed to be something where we're bringing together people who, you know, from all those various backgrounds, recognizing that there are overlaps between magic and psychology in the way that therapy would manifest, in the way that research could be done. Richard Kaczynski's done some excellent writing for us and is an example of a research-oriented psychologist who is exploring the interface with magic from that direction. So I see there's all kinds of possibilities in terms of other ways to go with this, but right now the workshops were fulfilling a need, and so that is the main focus right now.
Okay, well, I really appreciate you being on the show. I think it's important for people to know what's going on with the EGC and the pastoral counseling, and some people were not aware of 418 Lodge and what it's doing, so just kind of get all of this on some people's radar and so
right.
That they can participate if necessary.
Right.
Well, thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
All right, 93.
93.
I want to thank David for coming on the podcast. It's really important that people know what's going on with the OTO guilds and the other things that are going on with the local bodies. I know the Psychology Guild has been really moving forward with the pastoral counseling program, and there has been a lot of positive feedback about that. So it's great that he could be on the show. The next interview is with Keith418. In this one, Keith and I talk about confrontation within the Thelemic community. There has been some interesting patterns that we've noticed about people not really being able to confront others about problems and not really expressing how they feel. There's also a lot of misunderstanding about what we mean when we say confrontation, so Keith talks about that too. So here's our conversation about confrontation within the Thelemic community.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John. Thanks for having me.
One of the things you and I were talking about recently is conflict within the Thelemic community and how people are conflict averse. We find this out when a lot of people listen to the podcast and really dislike the confrontational tones that you and I have towards various leadership groups and other organizations. Why do you think they are so conflict averse?
I think you need to start out by making a differentiation between conflict and confrontation. I don't always think the community is conflict averse. I mean, people like a good fight. What they don't want to do is confront each other, and that's kind of a different issue. And, you know, one of the actual Grand Lodge officers brought this up with me not too long ago, that he said we have a very confrontation adverse community, that people complain about other people behind the scenes and behind their backs, but they don't actually confront these people directly. And I started thinking about this because I looked at the way Crowley really wanted Thelemites to behave at Cefalu. And he writes about this both in Cefalu and also after he left, after Mussolini booted him out of Italy in Tunis. And his whole attitude is that people should be very frank with each other and should confront each other if there's a problem. And in discussing this with some friends, you know, they brought up some really interesting issues about empowered people feeling that they can confront each other openly and directly and what that really involves. And often one of the things I found is that people confuse confrontation with resolution. I mean, oftentimes a confrontation between two people doesn't always result in a resolution. And so when people say, well, I don't want to confront X individual or I don't want to confront Y individual, you know, often it's because they don't really see that there's going to be a resolution. But Crowley says it's just important to clear the air, to know where everybody stands, to be frank with each other so that you have as much information as possible. And this is one of the things that I see being a real problem in the community. It's not just the fact that no one really wants to confront each other directly. And we saw that, actually, you'll recall this in the Kowalczyk study.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Remember, she points out that you could screw up really badly in the community and, like, blow a major project, and no one would ever confront you.
Exactly.
Because the whole community's whole take on Thelema is, we can't judge anyone else, and if you can't judge anyone else, you can't really confront them.
Well, actually, you can judge. You just can't have a negative judgment. So you can
give
praise all day long and judge something wonderful and successful and pat them on the back. Everyone says, that's great. But if you say, this sucks, or this is bad, or this isn't good, then people come down on you. So they're not really judgment-averse. They're negative judgment averse.
Negative judgment averse, right. Everything, that's exactly correct. So we look at this, and we say, well, how did it get this way, and what do we do to stop it? And I brought this up with a friend of mine who's no longer really in the community, and he said that it's naive to think that there can be this transparent accountability that will accede to confrontation across the board. And basically what that means, I think, is that, or how I interpret that, was that it's naive to think that a Minerva is going to go up to a sixth-degree OTO member and say, your behavior at this last event was totally appalling, and I want you to know that I think it's completely unacceptable and you had no right to, you know, run around with a banana on your head drunk out of your mind with your pants down. Or whatever. I mean, I'm just making something up. And he said, look, you know, the confrontations can only exist when there's a power relationship which would support the confrontation. And the question I think we need to ask ourselves, was Crowley really being naive? Was he insisting that people confront each other without that sort of power? Or was his vision of the kind of person he wanted in the Thelema community somebody that was so sure of themselves and so strong that not only could they go and confront people who were their, quote, superiors, unquote, but that also they could do it and be confronted?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know,
the person having the guts to go and confront someone. It's somebody who could stand to be confronted. And I mean, I think one of the reasons why more people don't confront us is that they're terrified of us confronting them back.
Right.
I mean, a lot of people don't realize this. You know, some people, yes, have confronted you about the podcast, but a lot of people just mutter about it behind the scenes and don't come out and say, you know, I really object to this, or I don't like this, or you shouldn't say this. And that it's very rare for that to happen. Instead, behind the scenes, you know, we hear people saying, oh, they're complaining about it. But people don't have, if you'll pardon the expression, the balls to come up to you in person and say, I think that's lame.
Right, and actually have more respect for people who do come up or send an email and say they dislike it. And I've had people email, and I read them on the air. It doesn't bother me at all.
That, right, but part of the problem is that confrontations, again, don't always mean reconciliation. They just mean more information is being shared.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that, you know, we have to look at, that just because you confront somebody about a problem doesn't mean the problem's going to get resolved. My argument, and I think Crowley's argument would be too, that there's a better chance of a positive resolution or a resolution of some kind happening with a confrontation than without it. But again, we go back to the Kowalczyk study, which is so hilarious and so unfortunate on a certain level because it was so from so long ago. You know, in the early 90s is when she did that study. Very little has changed.
Yeah, 15 the community years still doesn't, passed.
Right, the community still doesn't really want to confront problems directly. And the result of that is that things don't improve because nobody really knows when they've screwed up.
Well, the other thing is there are no goals. So the only thing that people could be confronting each other on is behavior and things like that, whereas a more healthy environment would have goals and projects that people would be working towards, and you'd be able to judge whether or not that was successful, and you would be able to look at milestones, and you could discuss that and confront people when they're not living up to those expectations.
Right, but everyone would be on the same page. You would know what your job was. You would know what your job responsibilities were. You would know what people were accountable for, so that if you were confronted, you could respond reasonably, as well as being in the situation where you could say, hey, look, you know, this person really needs to do this. And when you say confront people about behavior, what's interesting is that without goals and without a shared plan, the de facto kind of conduct rules are, you know, normative middle-class reality. The people that don't behave like normal middle-class people are the ones who violate those standards and tend to be the ones who get confronted. And the problem is that, of course, and this is like a big issue in the OTO, is that we run around telling everyone, do it, that will should be the whole of the law. And then when somebody misbehaves and acts like a maniac, everyone's sort of hesitant to criticize them because they've just been telling that person over and over again, and the entire time they've known them, do it, that will should be the whole of the law. And if the person in question turns around and says, well, it was my will to run around with a banana on my head, drunk out of my mind with my pants around my ankles, then it's difficult for that person to have a response.
Right. Well, the other thing is, if they don't confront people, all kinds of people go advancing in various directions, and then they blow up. And all of a sudden, it's
right.
Like, wait, how did this person get there? Why didn't we see this coming?
Right. Well, we've looked at this recently, too, in that confrontations also involve judgment. They involve making a decision. And they also involve a certain amount of knowledge. And I've seen people saying over and over again when some crazy maniac blows up in the community, in the larger Kalima community as well as in the OTO, the consistent comment is, well, we didn't see this coming. We didn't know. You know, you and I will ask, why did this person get promoted into a position of serious responsibility when they turn out to be maniacs who do terrible things? And the response always is, well, we didn't know that about him. We didn't know that about her. We thought she was fine. We thought he was fine. We didn't know. And when you start to examine it, you realize they don't know because they purposely avoided inquiring. They didn't want to look too closely, because if they looked too closely, they'd have to judge that person. And if Kalima is about not judging people, then it's better not to know, because it makes it easier not to judge. And if you don't know, then you can't confront, because you don't know what's going on. And you can detect within this a pattern of withdrawal from the community, which is ironic given the fact that everyone's pushing this concept of fraternity on everyone. How can you be fraternal with people you don't know?
Right.
And if you're promoting maniacs into positions of authority and importance where they can make decisions, and you turn around and say, well, I didn't know this person well enough, then you have to ask, well, what kind of fraternity is it when you don't know them well enough to know that they're a nut or not?
Right.
And we're not talking, you and I are not talking about a few isolated examples, are we?
No, I've seen this stuff happening since I've been in the Thelemic community and from the beginning of the 90s.
Right, over and over and over again. It's a consistent pattern. And what's appalling to me is this constant refrain, we didn't know. You know, they go after, how didn't you know? There's never that question, why didn't you know? Why did you withdraw your mind away from that situation? Now, a friend of mine today started laughing because I wrote a piece about this in which I said, gnosis is about knowledge. And if you don't know that someone's a nut or not, your gnosis is impaired. He thought this was funny. I'm like, well, I'm sorry, but Gnosticism is about knowledge. And if people think ignorance is bliss, or that not knowing people that well is going to protect, you know, your non-judgment morality, then you can't be a Gnostic.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. And I appreciate you being on the podcast again.
Thanks
Talk
for
to
having
you soon.
Me, John. Okay, 93.
Thanks to Keith for being on the show. I think these ongoing discussions about aspects within the Thelemic community are very useful. And as far as I can tell from the feedback I'm getting, people really appreciate the various topics that Keith brings up. So keep that feedback coming and let us know how we're doing. I certainly do forward those feedbacks to Keith when they reference him. The last interview is with author Stephen Ash. Stephen is the author of The Kabbalah of the 50 Gates and also the head of the organization FSR, or Fraternitas Sanctum Regnum, or Fraternity of the Sacred King. He has a number of books out. The first one, as I mentioned, is The Kabbalah of the 50 Gates. That was first put out by Mandrake Press in the UK a number of years ago. There is a new edition coming out that Stephen is publishing through Lulu Press with a new introduction. He's also has some books out called The Keys to the Rosicrucian Kabbalah, The Kabbalah, The Necrosis Codex, and The Kabbalah, The Testament of Solomon. All of these are very interesting books about various aspects of Kabbalah, using them in the magic. The one that is the Kabbalah, the Necrosis Codex, is the teachings of the first grade within his organization. All of these can be looked up off his website and purchased through that. He also has a number of CDs. We talk about those in the program. So he's got some very interesting ideas about Kabbalah and using Kabbalah to create a personal mythology. And I thought that was very interesting, too. So here's an interview with Stephen Ash. And this interview was done over Skype, so the sound quality is a little different. I had to kind of splice the two channels together in a linear format. So normally we'd be talking together, and I think it sounds okay, but it may be a little disjointed. So I hope you all can bear with that. It's a very interesting interview, though. So here's Stephen Ash. We have on the podcast Stephen Ash. Are you there, Stephen?
Hello, yes, John.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
93, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
For those who don't know, you're the author of The Kabbalah of the 50 Gates, published by Mandrake Press in the UK, and also a practitioner for the last 20 years within magic and the Kabbalah. Before we get into your Kabbalah and your book and everything, let's do a little a bit of your history. When did you join an order or get involved in an occult group in your life?
Well, I believe it all started stemming from my interest in the tarot in the mid-70s when I was in my teenage years, coming across various packs such as the Marseille deck and books on the tarot soon led to the Rider-Waite deck and also onto the Thoth deck. And it was impossible after a certain point, after consulting so many various works upon the tarot, not to come across the works of Aleister Crowley and the teachings of the Hermetic Golden Dawn. And so by the time I was 18 and I left home and established myself with some degree of independence from my parents and from the youth time of my life, as it were, I was already on the lookout for a magical order or someone who fitted into a chain of transmission that could perhaps pass on some teachings in a human way that would make sense to someone beginning the path. And I'd read in Francis King's Ritual Magic in England, which I believe is reprinted in the States as Ritual Magic. You may be able to correct me on that one. There was a chapter on the Order of the Cubic Stone, and I remember going to various sources, public libraries, knocking on doors of local publications, such as glossy magazines on the paranormal, which were being published from my hometown of Wolverhampton, and asking questions as to where I might find such people, and such people as the Order of the Cubic Stone, who were mentioned in Francis King's book. As it turned out, I'd asked so many questions, I'd already started to publish a number of underground periodicals on the old Xerox format of the 70s, a sort of post-Principia Discordia. Let me see, I remember one of these must have got into the hands of a local editor of one such esoteric periodical that was on the market at the time, and he turned up on my door, because I'd left my address after sending it in to him, with the head of the Order of the Cubic Stone, Robert Turner, who features in Francis King's work. And it was a meeting, they say, when the pupil is ready, the master arrives. It very, very much felt like that, and I think this is one of those meaningful synchronicities that occur within the life of anyone who's opened themselves and cultivated the capacity to seek the knowledge with open eyes and open ears. This is a mark of that seems to show itself in the lives of people like the young Crowley, happening upon Julian Baker and being led to George Cecil Jones, and through him the Order of the Golden Dawn. Little synchronicities like that can have amazing effects upon one's life, and it is a question of choosing one's moment to act, which is where the will is brought into the issue, and we are adherents of free will, thelema. And I think I chose my moments very well back there in 1979, when I more or less begged Robert Turner to accept me into the Order of the Cubic Stone as a pupil, and spent the next 2 years pursuing the probationer and Nicoris grades of the order, which more or less gave the full teachings of the Golden Dawn between Neophyte and Adeptus Minor. So I was very fortunate in that, being such a young man with such an open heart towards the path of Western Hermeticism, that the forces of destiny smiled favorably upon me, really. I'm very grateful for those opportunities. So I was actually involved on a level of preparatory Kabbalistic work, the work of preparing the self, during my period within the Order of the Cubic Stone, which was an honor to be in at the time of my membership.
And where did you go to after that?
Like many orders which are living and breathing creatures, which awaken and sleep, any esoteric order goes through cycles of expansion and decline, cycles of vitality, and then choking bureaucracy. And I think that if you are a member of any organization, be it the OTO, the AA, the OCS, the Order of the Cubic Stone, the Fraternity of the Sanctum Regnum, the order which I moved on to from the Cubic Stone, if one sticks around for long enough within the membership of these groups, you will see these cycles repeat themselves. And so the optimum period of membership for any individual within an official organized movement within the esoteric world is possibly limited by the fact that these cycles occur naturally, so that initiates are trained and move on to form their own groups, whilst new initiates take up the slack, as it were. So I moved on with two other members of the Order of the Cubic Stone, Diane Edwards and Francis Taylor, and formed the Fraternity of the Sanctum Regnum with a fourth member, John Edisbury, and that was in 1981, basically employing the as then unpublished works of the Golden Dawn tradition. I think many of these papers ended up in Regardi's, or is it the now the new Falcon version of the Golden Dawn? So, but back then we had access through our contacts within the Cubic Stone and the people we met. We're fortunate enough really to be able to grasp those teachings possibly only a few years before they became public property, but certainly at a time that made a key difference to a young order trying to flourish and make its name. We weren't the only splinter group from the Order of the Cubic Stone. There was also a quite successful group practicing in the north of England called the Order of the Serpent, but my associates and I formed the Fraternity of the Sanctum Regnum. And it's been living and breathing, going through periods of vitality and decline and cycles of rebirth ever since the early 80s.
Now, the FSR has done a number of publications, journals, CDs, and things like that.
Well, we always try to keep up with the cutting edge of technology, sometimes to our peril, because in the early 80s we made a video recording using very primitive equipment of some of the rites that we'd adapted and evolved from the Order of the Cubic Stone curriculum. Those tapes are possibly, unfortunately for some of us, still in existence. And they show a very embryonic technology at the time. If we were to replicate, you know, that attempt now, I'm sure the end result would be a lot more professional. But yes, we started off producing video and various pamphlets, still based on the old Xerox system, and moved through the 90s, really, in a variety of guises. As I say, any group lives and breathes. There are times when the Order of the Cubic Stone itself has been down to, you know, less than a handful of people, and then at other times it could hold hundreds of different adherents of the grade of probation and the chorus neophyte and the higher adepts, of course. But these things live and breathe, and as we've learnt to roll with the punches and roll with the changes and evolve through adaptation, you may have seen our work surfacing from little groups such as the New Age Knights Templar, which were a follow-on from the New Ordo Templar, the Order of the Templars of Newit of the early 90s. We produced a cassette recording of the Book of the Law, which was published by Ron Bonds of Illuminate Press. God rest his soul.
Right. We used the first chapter from that on the podcast. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yes, I remember. I was very pleased to hear it again. Associates of mine still have copies of the original cassette. I haven't one myself. So I was quite... I do believe, yes, you sent me, I believe, some MP3s. That's right. Thank you for those. That's the only copy I possess of those. But if I need access, I can get hold of a copy from a friend, I guess. But yes, that was quite a historic recording, because I believe a friend of mine came back from America and brought back the Principia Discordia, which Illuminate Ron Bonds had published. And we thought, well, these guys are okay. Let's see if they'll go for this. And as it turned out, he was publishing a cycle of books on aliens, on intelligences from other worlds or other dimensions, some specific references to Crowley's Book of the Law. And so it was quite a synchronicity that he got a meaningful coincidence that we should contact him at that time. And he was very good enough to put our work out in the Americas. But we've since made a possibly more definitive version of the Book of the Law, which I believe you played a sample from the other month. And that's one of our most recent recordings. What happened during the 80s was, and the 90s, although the ritual, the Kabbalistic side of ritual, a ritual inquiry and Kabbalistic attunement was very much emphasized during the 80s. During the 90s, we possibly loosened up a bit, went a little more ecological, and starting to have more involvement with ecological issues and taking care of the garden of creation and really earthing our work in Malkuth. In the mid-90s, I had the birth of my children, Kestrel and Alex, and we decided to cease operations ritually during the first few years of their lives, of course. because the atmospheres generated around esoteric workings, of course, shouldn't be young, growing, wonderful human beings shouldn't be exposed to haphazard influences. And so I believe that's when I took up university and did a late degree in interactive multimedia. And I believe that was when we started to actually gather the work together from the 80s and the early 90s and put them out on CD format to synthesize and crystallize the best of what we had to offer and put it in a format that was easily assimilated by the listening or the interested public. Yeah.
So I guess you have a Kabbalah series. It's called the Book of Calls, the Hermetic Kabbalah, and you also have some an introductory lecture about the Kabbalah of the 50 Gates.
Yes, well, I believe the stuff that we've put out, the material that we've put out on the CDs, is important because it focuses purely upon the Hermetic Kabbalah as opposed to the purely religious Kabbalah and the mysticism of the rabbinical Jews, of course, much of which is incorporated into the Western Hermetic tradition. But I find more and more as celebrities such as Madonna and Britney Spears and who knows who from MTV have gotten into the Kabbalah as a way of being, a path of self-discovery, all of which I applaud, the ground rules as to what is this Kabbalah have been somewhat confused. In the West, we've often based our understanding of the Kabbalah on what we term the Rosicrucian tradition. In itself, a tradition which is prone to a tradition of a transmission of information historically, which has been prone to interference patterns through wars, revolutions, the Black Death, the Crusades. And it's as if we have a fragmentation of knowledge that was brought together by some of the Latin scholars, Kircher and von Rosenroth, who was translated by MacGregor Mathers of the Golden Dawn. And these elements of what is often referred to as Masonic Kabbalism provide what we would term the Rosicrucian Kabbalah with its blood and guts, really, with its very meat. This has often been lost when examining the Kabbalah from the point of view of a purely religious, passive perspective, when the proactive magical side of evolving oneself within this work of personal evolution, you know, this tends to get lost in the mix in the religious passive side. I remember Gerald York on a radio documentary upon the subject of Crowley's life saying that the Golden Dawn was full of people of two camps. One was sitting at the feet of the deity and the other camp were trying to become the deity. And I think that those of us who tread the Rosicrucian path have some respect for the divinity within ourselves, within our very selves. And we're attempting to rationalize the Rosicrucian Kabbalah is an attempt to, it's a talismanic referencing system which gives us a sense of identification with our aspirations, not our emotional aspirations, but our spiritual aspirations, those aspects of the self that are capable of communing with the higher aspirational forces of the conscience. So we are very much involved as an order with providing the materials through which people can reference their own Kabbalah. There's things like 777, tables of correspondence, angelic calls, planetary invocations, all the hardcore nuts and bolts of the blueprints of the traditional Western Kabbalah. But we are really interested in cultivating the individual so that they can discover themselves, build their own personal referencing system, and stand on the shoulders of the giants such as Crowley and Mathers. So our small initiative hopefully will be appreciated either historically or in some cultural context. And it is indeed a pleasure to be involved in the active participation of the work of the Golden Dawn tradition, of which I'm very keen to include Aleister Crowley, who much of the Golden Dawn school have disassociated themselves from.
Now, you also talk in some of your writings about the influence of Dion Fortune and her Kabbalah.
Indeed, the very spot upon which I'm standing whilst I'm talking to you is only about 200 feet away from where she's buried, on the not so much the slopes of Glastonbury Tor, but on the lower foothills in the cemetery of Glastonbury in Somerset in England. And I have a very personal relationship with Dion Fortune's work, because when I entered my initial period of study, I was given her Mystical Kabbalah, her book, which I've grown to love and hate and then learned to love again throughout many cycles of my own development. But Dion Fortune's take is one of personal revelation, one of cultivating the self at the with the respect for the deity, the creator of the universe. I have a very deep personal love of Dion Fortune's spirit and the spirit with which she approached the work, which was one of honest sincerity and imagination. This is very much a case of a woman on her own going out into the world in the 1920s and investigating areas of human psychology and the esoteric areas of inquiry as a lone wolf, really. I don't believe she ever found personal happiness, save within her work. But I'm honored that I was brought to the path through reading her work, and every day in my heart, talk to her a little bit, you know. It's being so close to where she lies now. And I'm very grateful and thankful for her revelation of the esoteric knowledge.
Well, let's get into the Kabbalah of the 50 Gates, the book that you've written, and you're re-releasing a revised edition with a new publishing company.
Indeed, yeah. Vondel Park, who issued the CDs, we're pressing a few for the Americas, mainly because we've only been available in British bookshops or through Amazon.co.uk, and I think this is something to do with the post 9/11 impact upon international business. A few things were disrupted back then. I believe even Wiser were having trouble getting stock just after 9/11, and they're in America. But certainly the world's been standing back in shock since then, and we live in a different world. So really, I found that the audience with which my CDs have reached has mainly been in the Americas. And as we have a mail order turnaround of, I think it takes less than 7 days for our mail to reach many parts of the States via airmail, we've had a great response. So I thought it was really up to... Well, it's up to myself, really, to promote my own work in the Americas and hopefully support the first edition, which is available through Mandrake over here. So I've gone to the Lulu.com, and our website is, or our store on Lulu.com is /Kabbalah, Lulu.com/Kabbalah. So a variety of works will pop up on there, but we have the advantage of being able to print in America and print in Spain. So whether we're reaching a European audience or an audience in the Americas, everyone's assured of a pretty swift delivery.
Excellent. Now, I read the new introduction, and it starts off kind of quoting Karen Armstrong and pointing out that in the past there was this mythological understanding of existence, and it was more of a narrative of myth than actual literal reasoning, but now people approach things through a logical deductive reasoning, and that's kind of stripped a lot of the narrative and myth out of people's lives. And I found your contrast between that and how the Kabbalah can help bring that myth back in. If you'll indulge me to read a paragraph here, it says, "The concepts of the Hermetic Kabbalah are ideal tools to assist in the mining of some of the subcontextual ideas inherent in the mix of our everyday personal reality. These illusions of subcontext, elements of racial unconsciousness, or archetypes of timeless relevance, which commonly furnish our dreams, are often revealed in feelings of déjà vu, synchronicities of time and space, and numerological coincidences which plague us. This is the stuff, mythic personal signs and augurs fathomed only by the circumstance of the individual. What I like about this is you're taking the Kabbalah into a different direction. Instead of it just being the paths and the spheres and everybody learning it, you're saying, yes, you need to learn those aspects. You need to learn the paths, the spheres, the correspondences, but then take those and use it to create your own personal mythos. Can you explain a little more about what that is and how the 50 gates is a manifestation of that?
Sure. We have to start on the basic principle that the Tree of Life is a blueprint, which gives us a referencing system. So we can communicate between ourselves various ideas and understand their place within any particular area or blueprint of the blueprint of creation. At first, we can only work with ourselves, and we live in a dramatic universe. J.G. Bennett pointed this out. J.G. Bennett was a pupil of Gurdjieff, that without the drama of life, without the drama of an interior life, then life fails to have any meaning. And therefore, we have to realize our roles, our role as actors on a stage of our own making. We live in an environment of the creation, which is the garden of the creator, which is very much dependent upon our own interaction with our environment. The ancient Greeks believed that the eyes emitted little rays that interacted with the rays of the sun. And some of the recent findings in quantum physics seems to take into account the interplay between the observer and the observed, not so much just in a manner which is to do with the context and perspective, but very physically to do with an interactivity between our very selves and our environment that is goes on the photon level. And in fact, there is some theory that says we emit photons, and the photons that we receive are either annihilated or absorbed or reflected. At the moment, we live in a universe that has a constant amount of electrons, but has a variable amount of photons. But we are participants in the creation of our reality. The Kabbalah gives us a blueprint through which we can understand how we compartmentalize various aspects of our perceptive faculties, whether it's the brain's ability to make ordered choice, or the brain's ability to have an emotional response to a particular set of circumstances. We know that these the logical aspects of the brain can be mapped onto Hod, the sphere on the Tree of Life, to do which is linked to Mercury, the planet Mercury, complexity and order. And we know our emotional responses, our hormonal glandular responses, may be linked to the Sephira Netzach. Now, the common manner in which the individual on the Golden Dawn tradition approaches the Tree of Life is through symbolic ritual practice. That is, they will enact little plays in which they steep themselves with the paraphernalia of ritual, of the ritual environment suited to a particular sphere. And this is all very well, and results magically are obtained. Now, it's my contention, and it's the contention of the order to which I belong, the FSR, that magic is above mere wonder working, is above mere pure mastery over one particular area of the creation or another. Magic is a process of self-realization, and it is very much a process rather than it's an activity. And the Kabbalah of 50 Gates, rather than symbolically enacting the ritual virtues of any particular sphere, is really about experiencing and mapping one's own response to those elements of the creation that can be identified with the various Sephiroth upon the Tree of Life, and realizing these as cusps of experience. Wisdom is the residue of experience, and wisdom is our ultimate goal. Wisdom is the title of the second Sephira, Chokhmah. Now, this is obviously a union, a vision of God face to face, and an ultimate self-realization, a realization of the inner divinity. But the Kabbalah of 50 Gates teaches that the bottom sphere, Malkuth, the bottom sapphira, Malkuth, the sovereignty of the creation, often referred to as the kingdom, contains a mini blueprint of 10 experiences which can be communed with, understood. The sphere above this, having undergone these 10 states of realization, then one transcends Malkuth in one's approach to the creation and deals with the 9 experiences of Yesod, and similarly the 8 experiences of Hod and the 7 experiences of Netzach, until we finally end up with the 4 gates in Chesed, the 4th of the Sephiroth, where one is confronted with the "there are 4 gates to one palace" reference from the Book of the Law, the palace of Darth, union, knowledge in a biblical sense, in a semi-mystical sexual sense of uniting with the Godhead. And so the Kabbalah of 50 Gates is about transcendence. It is, rather than pathworking, which is guided visualization, and then the response to that guided realization in visionary or revelatory terms, the Kabbalah of 50 Gates is about awakening. And so one may have an experience within any of, say, the 6 experiences of Tifereth, which will provide an insight, a eureka moment, or a moment of deep inner knowledge and conviction of certainty. So it's certainty and not faith, as promised by the Book of the Law. And what I've done is I've mapped the various experiences, my personal experiences of the 50 gates, to the best ability that I've been able, and offered it really as a sign to myself that I've been able to define to this degree this level of achievement or of insight. And really, one does these things for oneself, but if the world finds it entertaining or diverting, and I've been told that the book is quite interesting from several lateral points of view, then I believe it deserves its place in the market. And so building a personal mythology is really about recognizing those things which are eternally valid to the self, finding their reference within a talismanic referencing system such as the Tree of Life, if only so that one can make sense of these things to oneself. But of course, the true measure of achievement in any particular area is the ability to be able to pass that knowledge on. And the way I've chosen to do this has been through the use of parable and allegory, and just hang on to my hat and hope that I carry most of the audience with me in some parts, some of the audience with me in other parts. And if the audience lose their grip on an understanding, at least their curiosity will be piqued so that they may return to the riddles and the parables that I've presented there. And so it's really a piece of work from the heart. But does that answer your question?
Absolutely.
Good.
So what are the upcoming projects from the FSR?
Well, at the moment, we have a variety of projects which are semi-public documents on sale through a variety of means. We put the odd piece of work out on eBay just to keep people attuned to what's going on, what's available here or there. I believe that we've now finished the CD series. We have a series of the standard potboilers, the magical works which are necessary for the student in order to work the work of the order, and of course which will be available on a casual basis to any interested observer. They can email me or consult our website, which I believe you're going to reference on your page. Let me see, really, which leaves me personally time to complete my sequel to the 50 Gates, which is called Lucifer in Paradise, Kabbalah of 32 Paths.
And what is the the 32 paths going to, is it more of an allegorical narrative about seeing the 22 paths and the 10 spheres as 32 paths all together?
I think you could call it the adventures of the single electron, yeah, responsible for all of manifestation, yeah. But again, it will be told in an allegorical form with puzzles, riddles, and conundrums. But I'm so enchanted with the writing of it. I've taken a mythological approach. It is based in the Glastonbury Zodiac. It features the evolved spirit of Dion Fortune, and it's written in a novel form, which should interest and hopefully entertain or at least divert Kabbalists. And if it doesn't leave them scratching their heads or smiling, then I guess it may leave them wanting to kick my ass, but as long as it has an effect.
All right. Well, that sounds good. And again, for other people to go, your website is uk.geocities.com/Golden Dawn Lodge, all one word.
That's right.
And that has links to all of the books and the CDs that we talked about that are publicly available. Is there an email address for people to get in touch with you? Do you have that?
Yes, anyone can email me on glastonburyinavalon@yahoo.co.uk, and that enables me to pick my mail up from wherever I am.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate your time and the things that you're putting out. I've listened to a number of the CDs and read a number of the things from you, and I'm really happy that this material is coming out, so I want to encourage people to support you and check it out. Is the FSR accepting students at this time, if somebody's interested?
Yes, well, they can email me. They could always find a link from our website to email the order. Generally, I think we accept twice a year. We haven't accepted for around a year so far due to changes in my personal circumstances, settling in Avalon, getting married, various things like this. But we are opening the gates sometime in the next 3 months to like-minded souls. We don't charge a lot of money. It's more about, can we find a happy band to go to, you know, onwards with, and together share and find the secrets of what we're all looking for, enlightenment and contentment. So if anyone wants to join in, email, we won't induct them into any unheard of cult or anything like that. It's just about companionship upon the path and building a network of people with like minds.
Now, is there physical initiations, or can most of it be done via correspondence?
Well, I believe most of the work is always done by the individual, but it does help when that individual finds guidance, not only from people who've trodden the path before him or her, but from their fellow companions upon the path. So, there's a great plethora of occultists that will, in the words of Frank Zappa, do anything for $50. We don't initiate over the telephone or offer weird, wacky rites in the absence of the individual. But we do periodically spring up and hold little initiation lodges in which quite a psychodrama is enacted in order to open the gates of the psyche of the individual. And periodically, those who stick around longest and do their fair share of the work will be rewarded within the order by what blessings we are able to confer. But we don't, in the words of Frank Zappa, do anything for $50.
Again, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it. 93.
Well, thank you, John. 93.
This brings us to the end of another Thelema Coast to Coast. Thanks again to all of the guests, David Shoemaker, Keith418, and Stephen Ash. Appreciate you taking the time and being on the show. I will have links to all of the various things we discussed, 418 Lodge, and also to the websites of Stephen Ash. As I said earlier, I have a special treat for the outgoing song. On July 11th, Lon Milo Duquette released his White Album, and these are 10 songs that Lon has recorded in acoustic, guitar, and singing. A lot of them are very amusing in their titles. Songs like I'll Bring You a Cold Drink, or I Love to Get Drunk in the Car, Monkey Meat, I've Never Met a Little Man I've Liked, Don't You Know I Know I'm Wrong, or Porno Queen. They all sound very amusing. The song that I have as the outgoing music is the fifth track off the album, called Sweet Babylon.
Thanks to Lon for sending that in. And I will have a link to Lon's album on the Thelema Coast to Coast website and in the show notes. Also a reminder that Thelema Coast to Coast is broadcast on paganradio.net on Wednesday nights, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, and then the associated time difference with that. So if you know someone who doesn't have the ability to download and listen to MP3s either on their computer or with some kind of MP3 player, you can point them to paganradio.net and they can listen to it streaming from there. So thanks again for listening to the show. Show 31 will be coming out in a few weeks. Hope you stick around for that one. Love is the law, love under will.
People keep saying that Jesus is Lord. He'll take me in the rapture. He'll come with a sword. Preachers on TV tell me I'm living wrong. But I've tasted the lips of sweet Babylon. Sweet Babylon, oh heavenly harlot, let down your hair and take me to bed. Hold out your cup and I'll pour the wine. Drink to the night of sweet Babylon. I know they call you the queen of damnation, our sacred love abomination, but dying in your arms is sweeter than salvation. Heaven is the night of sweet Babylon. Sweet Babylon, oh heavenly harlot, lover of all, refuser of none. Hold out your cup and I'll pour the wine. Drink to the night of sweet Babylon. Heaven is the night of sweet Babylon.